This week, we're sponsored by Walt Life. Walt Life is a subscription box service that handpicks fun items from you from around Disney parks. You can choose a subscription box for basically any price level, ranging from, I think, like $30 all the way up to like $69. There are tons of options. I'm sure I'm missing them. They have a snack box, a Disney box, a Star Wars box. You just pick Marvel box. You pick what you want, and they mail it right to you, which is fantastic. You can use the promo code MONORAILNEWS10 to get 10% off your first order. That's the code MONORAILNEWS10 for 10% off your first order.
You're listening to a Monorail News production. Now, get ready to step into the magic.
Hello and welcome to Monorail News Weekly, or Magic Time, as it's now called. We have been off a week while I was on vacation to Walt Disney World. Short answer, it's been good. Long answer, I don't really like face masks that much, but I'll deal with them because it's for public health. This week, we have my friend Maya Nguyen on the show. You might wonder, A, who is Maya Nguyen, and B, what does she have to do with Disney? And the answer is that she's a singer, and she doesn't really have anything to do with Disney, but I wanted to talk to her, so you're going to have to suffer through this episode if you don't like it. I think you will, though. Maya, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So for our audience who maybe doesn't know you, maybe they do, give me a little bit of your background.
So as you said, I'm a singer-songwriter. I do act as well, but I've been playing music professionally for the last 6 years. I make cover songs on YouTube, but I also have original music, and I've toured across the country.
Yeah, that's it's very, very impressive. So I don't mean to be dismissive there, but just moving on to the next thing. How did you get started? Did you have like a love of music as you were a kid, or is it something that you fell into later? How did your love of music develop?
That's a great question. I've always loved music. I remember first playing the piano when I was 3 years old and writing my first songs on the piano when I was about six. And I've always participated in choir and band, anything musical growing up. And it's always just been such an important part in my life. I've processed a lot of things through music in my life. And so it's always just been a source of healing, and I don't know, it's just a wonderful part of my life. So I love music.
Well, no, that's totally fair. And playing piano at age three, that makes me look like a total slouch. I tried to learn piano as a kid, mostly at the behest of my mother, and I hated it. My thing is, I'm not a huge fan of like practicing, which is obviously essential in music. So I would just, I plateaued early and then just fell from there. When I first noticed you, you had seemingly read the same book I read. If you're a fan of The Hunger Games, you might know that a prequel came out this summer during coronavirus called A Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. It is phenomenal. I think it's the best book in the series, but that's just me. And you took music from the book. Now, if you haven't read the book, one of the main characters is also a singer-songwriter. And so there's tons of music in the book. Some of it's adapted from like old poetry or old folk songs, but a lot of it is original music written by Suzanne Collins. And my problem when I was reading the book was that I had trouble converting lyrics on a page with no sheet music to an actual song. And I stumbled upon what you were doing on Reddit. I'm on the Hunger Games subreddit. And I just completely was like blown away and was like, wow. So tell me, how did you first, come to the book? How did that happen? Were you a long-term fan of the series or,
Yeah, I've always enjoyed the Hunger Games series. And, I think especially right now, I have a lot of extra time to read since we're all in lockdown. So it's kind of a no-brainer for me to read it. But especially, I found the name very intriguing as a as a songwriter, I was wondering how much music would be in the book, just from the title alone. And lo and behold, there were so many songs. And as I was reading, because I'm a musician and a songwriter, I couldn't help but turn them into songs in my head. I kind of had the opposite problem as you, in that my brain would get distracted from the story because it just kept trying to focus on the music and would just come up with different melodies. And I just kept thinking about it. So this was actually a way for me to get those ideas out of my head. And it's been a lot of fun to create videos and songs out of those lyrics. But yeah, that's sort of how I stumbled into it.
Okay. So I'll be honest. When I read the first song, I was listening to it on audiobook, actually. So like I said, I wasn't reading, I was listening. When I heard the narrator who voiced Hans in Frozen, he was like, it was, I don't remember what the lyric was, but it was very dry, and it was like, I don't even really know how to go. I wish I had the lyrics in front of me now. But whatever it was, I was reading, I'm like, oh my God, this is awful. I might put the book down forever. But suffered through it and really did enjoy it. So what was your reaction when you first read the book and, you know, had your presumptions confirmed that the book would contain lots of music?
I was excited, but I also think the first song, because it's that the reaping song, is sort of the weirdest song in the book. It's the weirdest moment to be singing. And so it does kind of throw you off a little bit. It's surprising. And at first, my brain didn't really know what to do with it either. But as I thought about it more, you know, this is sort of it, that first song is sort of her rebellious moment and a moment for her to maybe sing one last song to an audience. And yeah, it's really interesting. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought about different arrangements and different possibilities for it. I think that's the one that also has the most different interpretations. Some people read that and think she's yelling or like having some sort of rock out scream moment. Other people interpret it as being sort of like a country song, or there's just so many different interpretations for that song in particular, I think, because it's so strange. But yeah, I definitely was thrown off a little bit by that one at first, but the more that I thought about it, the more excited I got about the music side of it. And every song after that just kept getting me excited to make into music. And so I enjoyed it a lot. I love the music component of the book.
Well, you know, and I think my problem was that I knew the book was going to be made into a movie because they already inked the deal and got like Francis Lawrence to come on and direct it. He directed the last of the Hunger Games movies, Catching Fire and Mockingjay. And I'm like, I cannot see how this does not end up like a cheesy Disney Channel original movie.
Yeah.
And hearing a competent performer like yourself do the music really alleviated me of that fear. And makes me a little more hopeful. I mean, I don't know if they'd cast you for the movie, but, you know, fingers crossed.
I would love that. That would be such a dream come true. I mean, I'm pretty much your average random person out there in the world. I don't really have connections to that industry very well. I've done some independent films as an actor, but that's really far away from the world of a film that big. And maybe if, you know, by some magical chance in this world, they watch my videos and give me an audition, that would be the coolest thing ever.
Well, you know, and I don't want this, so I kind of want this to devolve into a discussion about the book, but I'll try and keep it a little bit more, you know, like if you haven't read the book, you can still read the book and not have it spoiled for you by me. read the book. So I felt when I was reading the book, when I was introduced to the character of Lucy Gray, who's the singer-songwriter in the book, and of course she is being mentored in The Hunger Games by Corlania Snow. First off, I was interested in the fact that at some point in the book, Coriolanus realizes that he actually doesn't like music, and that he's totally just lying, and he's maybe more just infatuated with the girl. Because he has to tell Sejanus, his father, Mr. Plinth, later, he's like, what do you have in common with your mother? I knew your mother when I came to the Capitol. And he's like, oh, she likes music. I like music. And then, like, later, he's like, I think I hate music. I don't know. To me, that was an interesting window, I think, into Coriolanus and how he is willing to take something maybe that he doesn't like, but manipulate it and use it for his own gain, right? Like, I don't think at first he really cared about Lucy Gray or the music, right? I think he saw that as a way to differentiate her and by extension himself and win the Hunger Games. I don't know if that changes. Mm-hmm. What was your thought on that whole kind of character development between Coriolanus and Lucy Gray?
I would definitely agree with that. I think that his association, like whatever he enjoyed out of music, was almost always related to a different emotion he was getting out of it, whether it was a sense of power or control. And I think that's what he enjoyed about certain aspects of those musical moments. It wasn't that he was necessarily actually enjoying the music itself. I do think that there's a duality to Snow, especially early on in this book, and it sort of reveals that, like, given different circumstances, yes, his thought process is messed up, but maybe given different circumstances, he wouldn't have ended up being the person he became, but that it was a series of choices that he definitely made that turned him into that person. I think it's really interesting. Like, I think there's seeds in there, like a little tiny part of him, I think, enjoys the music, but most of him enjoys the power, you know? Yeah, I think that's an interesting take on it. But I would definitely agree that mostly he doesn't really enjoy music.
That's very, very fascinating. You know, when I read the book, I don't know about you, at what point were you mortified by Coriolanus? Like, at what point do you think that, like, he was at the point of no return? Because I think my perception on Coriolanus's morality came for me at a different point than most people reading the book. Do you feel...
For me...
Yes, go ahead.
No, that's an interesting question. I think for me, it was pretty late in the book. Like, I felt like he was redeemable for most of the story. It wasn't until the third part of the book, the choices that he made when he was in the districts, that solidified his decision to be that person in my mind. You know, up until that point, he was still sort of redeemable, even though his thought process was messed up. He sort of still had the ability to be a better person. But for me, it wasn't until, like, what happened with Sejanus, no spoilers, but that was sort of the turning point for me and how solidly I felt about him as a person.
Yeah, because I mean, I think for me it was clear he's like a sociopath from the beginning of the book, but like I think mm-hmm. most politicians are sociopaths to an extent. So I didn't really think, you know, he's like, oh my god, you know, this guy shouldn't be ever run a country. You know, he's a monster. You know, that didn't really hit me until the third chapter or the third section of the book when he. Actually, you know what? Screw it. I'll give you a spoiler. When he basically turns Sejanus in and gets him killed, mm-hmm. To me that was the moment where it's like, okay, this guy really is a bad guy. And I don't know if he always was a bad guy, you know, or if the situation that he was in led him to do things that he otherwise wouldn't have done.
Yeah, right? I totally agree with that.
I think that's, you know, an interesting thing even in real life when we look at, you know, are people naturally born evil, right? Like Hitler, right? Would Hitler have been evil if certain events in his life didn't happen the way they happened? Right, like, that's an extreme example. But...
Yeah, I think there's definitely people who are predisposed to be more terrible in their lives because of the way that they think and the way that their brains work. I think that there are people like Coriolanus and, as a fictional character, It gets more complicated when you start talking about Hitler, real life people who did very, very horrible things. But as far as like Coriolanus go, I think he's definitely somebody who naturally leans more to being a selfish person.
Right. No,
and I think that's sort of the heart of it, you know, like making selfish decisions. And where does that stop? Does that ever end? And when it starts going into territory where you're literally disposing of other people's lives for your own benefit, then you're sort of past the point of being a
right
good person.
Well, and I want to make it very clear. I don't think Hitler had any like small little bit of a good person in him. I think it's very, very clear that like he's evil through and through. But I do think that some people can make an interesting argument about really any historical figure, right? You go look at Winston Churchill, and if you're in the UK, he's a national hero who led the country triumphantly through World War II. But if you're from India, he's a horrible monster who committed horrible atrocities to your people, right? And in some ways, you know, a matter of perspective. Like, I don't know if in the main trilogy of the book, if people in the capital would have seen President Snow as being so evil like people in the districts did, right? Like, you know, I think that if it's not really hurting you, it's easier for you to dismiss it.
Like, totally. I mean, we see that every day. We see that here in our own country. We see that across the world. How do terrible people become powerful to begin with? I mean, they still have to have supporters. And why do they gain support? And why? I think it really comes down to empathy as well. How are we able to empathize with the plight of other people, with the struggles of other people? And that's really prevalent today in our world as well. And I think, you know, that's sort of the point of these books too, is to make you think about that and think about how these situations reflect on our own
world. Right. You know, and one thing that I thought was very, very interesting about the book, I just taken a course on the American Revolution, and a lot of what we talked about, we read your primary sources, your John Locke and Hobbes and Rousseau, you know, these influential works like the Second Treatise of Government and Leviathan and even Frankenstein, that's the later one, which are all in the epitaph of this book, really come up, those ideas that those great Enlightenment thinkers thought of comes up in the book in a very interesting way, right? And like the Cliff Notes version of that is that Hobbes basically believed that people are inherently evil and that they need a strong central authority to keep them in check. Of course, in the book, we see that manifested in the Capitol, and that's definitely Coriolanus's point of view. But then you have Locke, who took the totally opposite point of view, that people are naturally good people and that we don't necessarily need that large central authority, and that we agree. Actually, you want to scrap that. I'm not going to do a great job of explaining either of those things. Point is, it's really deeply rooted in the book, and I thought that was interesting in terms of, you know, just giving the book a you know, a real intellectual basis rather than just being a fun book for teenagers, right? Like, I don't know if you felt like there was, you know, bigger messages in the book that make it relevant to people who aren't just huge fans of The Hunger Games.
Absolutely. I think that that's part of why they're so successful, is because the books and the story are very much based on real life situations and reflections of humanity and human nature and what brings us to these points in society, what brings us to the point of killing and what brings us to the point of all of the horrible things that we've done in human history. And I think it's something that we should be thinking about more, and the psychology behind why some of the things that happen in our world happen. And it really is interesting because you do see that duality in the book between, are we naturally good or are we naturally just crazy, horrible people? What is it that we are? And I think obviously not a simple answer, because I think everybody comes out of reading these books with different perspectives and different thoughts, and there's no one clear answer to that question.
And if it's not my perspective, it's wrong. No, not really. everyone should think like me. No. That's why I think you're talking about books like this on a deeper level than just going, oh my gosh, Sejanus is so hot, you know, or whatever we do when, like, you're a teenager and you're reading these books for the first time. I don't know, because I'm not in that boat. Maybe, you know, is far more rewarding than, or is less rewarding than taking, you know, a critical intellectual eye. And I don't mean that we should all sit around and be like, are the curtains red because they represent the blood of the people Coriolanus killed? Or are curtains just red? Right? Like, that's like my least favorite thing in English class. And they're like, what do the white shutters mean? I'm like, how about just white shutters? Okay? Stop.
Right. I think there's definitely a point at which you can overanalyze things, for sure.
And I thought it was really.
Yeah, I think.
Go ahead.
No, but yeah, I think you're right. I think you're missing some important points that the books are making if you're not thinking any deeper than your attraction for the characters in the book, which is also definitely a part of the book. I mean, it's hard to ignore that as part of the success of the series as well. I mean, you have characters that people relate to, that people want. You know, people are now are there's so many people that fantasize about Lucy Gray now because she's easy to relate to, and she's people imagine her as being this beautiful person, physically as well as she is clearly in the book, to a lot of people, just a beautiful person in general. And so now you have all these people that are like imagining, you know, what it would be like to know Lucy Gray in person. So I do think that, you know, well, yeah, the Janus is so hot. Thought process is very surface level. It does play in, I think, to in an interesting way to how we perceive characters as well.
I think I should make that into a t-shirt and sell it on the Monreal News t-shirt store.
yeah.
But it would only be funny if you listen to this podcast. I don't think that would resonate, like, with the outside world at all. But, you know, I thought what was really interesting to me in the book, and I've completely disregarded, you know, spoilers now, so, like, you should have stopped listening like 15 minutes ago if you plan to read the book. But I thought the way that Dr. Gall very, very clearly has a Hobbesian point of view and how she pushes Coriolanus to have that same point of view, you know, that people need the capital, that the districts are inherently less civilized than the enlightened people in the capital are. You know, and therefore they need that strong central authority to survive. I thought that was very interesting. And I almost wonder if we get sequels, which I think we will. I think this is going to be a trilogy. That's my uneducated opinion. I have no knowledge of what Suzanne Collins or Lionsgate has plans to do, but I easily see this being more than just one book. I think we'll see at some point that Coriolanus is going to liquidate Dr. Gall, just like he liquidated Dean Highbottom and Sejanus and maybe Lucy Gray. I think that it's Dr. Gall that kind of twisted Coriolanus and helped to make him the monster we see in the original trilogy.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And it's actually an interesting, because you talk about these two different, very polar opposite viewpoints, and maybe that's really the point that the book is trying to make. Like, we are not necessarily inherently evil or good. We are just energy. And it's the choices we make and the influences around us that push us towards one direction or the other. And I think Dr. Gall is definitely a very important and influential part of Coriolanus' choice to go towards the evil path, I guess, so to speak.
And, you know, one thing that really struck me is I hope we get more detail about The World Before the Dark Days. Like, I feel like we still didn't get enough about that. Because when you mm-hmm. look at, you know, revolutions, and especially civil wars in history, right? Like, for the most part, the ruptures in the American Civil War, like the fact that it could at any moment, you know, violently break out again and we could all, you know, be fighting a war from 150 years ago, you know, that's pretty well behind us. You know, there's the cultural divide, but we are more or less a united country, right? Panem never had that, right? And that's in part because of Dr. Gall's doing with her Eternal War, right? The idea that the Hunger Games would be like a continuation of the rebellion every single year and never allow the country to, you know, heal and to bind up the nation's wounds, as Abraham Lincoln said in his second inaugural, right? I think that the Capitol could have held on to its power if they didn't have the Hunger Games. And I know that's,
yeah.
that's kind of a an out there remark because we're talking about one book, but and that's like an overarching trilogy thing. But you know, I don't think that in the original book that if there was not a Hunger Games that people wouldn't have tried to revolt. Right, I think that the Hunger Games are the impetus for the Second Civil War and the eventual overthrow of the Capitol.
Yeah, well, and I think if there wasn't a Hunger Games, I think the inevitable essentially blend of the districts and the Capitol would have happened. I think over time, those segregated areas would have slowly begun to
integrate.
Yeah, I think without the Hunger Games, I think over time it would have just become one nation of people versus the divided, war-stricken, whatever you, however you would
right.
describe. Yeah, I think, yeah, that's a really important point to make. I think, yeah, because it's this, in some way, this never-ending war, they're never not feeling on the edge of that, of revolution of
again
violence,
right
of, yeah
I mean, if you look at countries like I mean I think even if the Capitol had been oppressive to an extent, right, we look at countries like the Soviet Union, and they, you know, the government there was awful, right? You don't want to live in the Soviet Union. The government was like, you know, a very totalitarian, you know, state, and they didn't have a successful civil war, you know, throughout their like 90-year history, right? And people, and it did, of course, dissolve, but it didn't dissolve because people were like rioting in the streets, right? It,
yeah,
it was mainly outside pressure, but that's beside the point. And I think that, you know, the when you look at the 75 years between the end of the rebellion and the second revolution in the Hunger Games series, that you probably could have seen a similar thing. Right, like maybe eventually the government would have voluntarily almost, you know, reformed and disbanded, and a new state would have, you know, emerged out of the rubble, but I don't think it would have been as bloody. Right, and I know that that is, once again, kind of off topic, but that's what I kept coming back to when I was reading the book. You know, I was reading it and was trying to piece together, you know, and sketch out the details, you know, in a dystopian world where in the first trilogy, let's be real, we really didn't get a lot of world building, right? Like how the whole world came to be, like Katniss was basically like, yeah, I slept through history class. Good luck. and just like, it was like, yeah, there were some wars and like climate change. And it wasn't, you know, really sketched out for us. So I hope that this book, I think, helped with that. And I hope that if they do write more books, that they can sketch in more of that. But I understand that's difficult to do, right? Like, it's hard to envision the whole modern world falling apart, and then like how does it pick up the pieces? It's far easier just to leave it vague. And my question to you was, do you think there are, this is directly related to the book, do you think there are other people outside of Panem? Because that was kind of hinted at in this book.
Yeah, I mean, I think essentially what I've gotten is that Panem itself is essentially I'm assuming where the U.S. is.
In North America.
Sort of alternate universe. I do think that there's people outside of Panem. I think it's hard to say. As you said, they haven't explained a lot of how they got to where they got, to know for sure what the world is like outside of Panem. And it also, I think, speaks to the possible brainwashing of the people inside the capital. And maybe that's part of it, is they're starting to establish the brainwashing of the kids in the schools in the capital, that they're telling them there is no life outside of Panem, where the people in the districts, like Lucy and her family, the Kobes, are pretty sure that there's people outside of Panem and the districts, because they've toured outside of there and played for people living outside of there. You know,
right.
I think to me that was sort of establishing the misinformation that's being told to the children in the capital and taught to them. And maybe that's part of the brainwashing that allows for the development of a person like Coriolanus to become powerful in that state.
So, that country. By the time we read in the first book, which is chronologically after this, they seem to have worked that there are no other people, we are it, mentality into the districts as well. And I almost wonder if it's some sort of a North Korea pariah state, you know, that like intentionally lies to their people. And like in reality, you know, Europe's just fine, you know, and Panem is like the odd one out in, you know, geopolitical relations, that like they're like the, you know, the totalitarian hellscape that no one wants to like touch with a 10-foot pole, because they have like a massive refugee problem. Like with North Korea. And I think we come closer with this series to getting an answer to that, because if there are organized societies outside of Panem, the people within the country who have the most chance of interacting with them are definitely the leaders in the capital. Right? Like they would be the ones who would have limited diplomatic, you know, ties to the outside world, or at least would know about the outside world.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the only flaw in that theory is that there's still modern technology throughout even the districts. There's still televisions. There's still, like, I feel like if that were to happen in this day and age with the technology that they do have, where they have microphones and televisions, and like, where does that end, and where does that lack of information, how are they able to maintain that lack of information in still a digital era is the main, I feel like, flaw in that theory.
I mean, I always kind of assumed, you know, it's just like any other totalitarian nation where they have, you know, a firewall and, you know, no, there's a blockage of most digital information, you know, that yes, you have television, but it can only tune into state-run frequencies, right? You can't hop on over to the next country over's, you know, TV signal, right? And I don't know that. I'm not even really a proponent of the North Korea theory, but it's always something that just interested me. And cause I remember reading, there was another post-apocalyptic totalitarian book. I forget what it's called now, but like they were the North Korea type pariah state, and they also existed in North America. And you come to find out later in the series that like, oh, look at that. The rest of the world's still there. and is doing way, way better than they are, you know? I think that would be a funny thing to have happen. The thing that I think really destroys that theory is that once, you know, District 13 got like a sizable lead, I feel like other more democratic nations would have been, you know, piling on support, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which didn't happen. So that does kind of lend credence to the theory that, oh, well, if there are people out there, they're not organized like Panama is, right? They're not nation states as we think of them.
Right. They're probably equally unaware of what's happening in Panama.
Right. I mean, because like, I feel like if your country is having a ritualized child slaughter on an annual basis, someone's going to step in, right? Like, right? Like,
don't I hope
you,
so.
You would hope, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but honestly, I don't know if it came out that that's what North Korea was doing, if we would do anything, right? Like, I mean, that is a touchy situation, right? I mean, like, I'm sure they'd be finger wagging, but like, you know, it's so messy, you know, trying to go in and decapitate the government and what do you do with the people afterwards. And, you know, it's just a giant, giant headache. And it's the right thing to do, but it's not the politically advantageous thing to do always.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things to think about and how these issues reflect in our world. And yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's
lots of good thoughts.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's part of what makes the book so great is that you can make parallels to our world. You can think, you know, oh, well, if this was really happening in another faraway country, would we do anything? Right? Would we, you know, come to the aid of the people there? And it kind of forces you to also examine your own society, right? And where do you see, you know, the beginnings of, you know, of a bad system like they have in the Hunger Games novels, you know, in your real life? I remember before President Trump got elected, there was a tweet that I saw. And someone was like, he can't act. It was like 2015. He can't act to get elected. 2016. He can't really do that. 2017. I hope my district wins the Hunger Games.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's really easy to see parallels. I think also that's part of why, you know, as I've been releasing these songs, I've been donating the streaming sales to organizations that are helping with the situation that's happening right now in our world. And I live right outside of Portland. So a lot of my friends are protesting right now, are out there every night, and they're getting bruised up. The pictures are like, it's really scary. And there's a lot of scary things happening right now. And so it felt like it made a lot of sense to take the proceeds from this project and donate them to organizations that are helping. For the next three songs that I'm releasing, I'm donating to the Black Resilience Fund, which is a local organization helping to build better community for the Black community in Portland and get better resources for them. And so it's been really cool to also find a way through this project to try to make a positive change. And it's been kind of interesting sense, it's been a very full circle sort of project in that way.
Yeah, and I don't think you could have possibly known when you first started writing these songs after the book came out that this would happen, right? Like, just this whole situation with the global pandemic first. I mean, I'm really shocked just how much has happened in the past 6 months, right? Like, we are in a place that is so fundamentally different from how we entered this year, right? Like, it almost seems quaint that we were all worried about World War III back in January, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah. It's definitely tough. I think I'm honestly wondering by the time that this podcast gets out, what's going to change by then? I mean, things are changing at such a rapid pace. It seems that they're escalating so quickly, and there's the threat of, like you were saying, the postponing the election, which I don't think will happen. I really hope it doesn't. But, you know, there's all these possibilities up in the air of how things could unfold. And so it'll be a really interesting test of time. By the time this podcast gets out, what's going to change? Where will we be at?
And well, it's coming at midnight tonight. So I certainly hope a lot doesn't change.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, I hope so too. That's a better turnaround than I was imagining. But even just a week from now, I wonder, how are things going to change? How will things unfold? And I really, really hope with all of my heart that it will be in a way that is good for humanity. That's what we need right now. More positive things in this world, more good-natured energy.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for listening to me and Maya ramble about a book that you might not have read that has no relation to why you initially subscribed to this podcast. I promise you we'll be back with more Disney next time. Maya, where can they find you and your work?
The best place to find me is on YouTube. My name is spelled M-A-I-A-H-W-Y-N-N-E. You can find all of the songs that I've done for this book and other songs as well on my YouTube channel.
And you can find us at monorailnews.com or at Monorail News on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And you can find me at Gray Hauser. That's Gray with an A, Hauser. You all have a great, big, beautiful tomorrow, and I'll see you in the next one.